You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
So we're going to have the election podcast here in a second with Phil Stutz. Phil, how many elections were you the campaign manager of, your company was involved in this midterm elections?
About 107.
107 elections in the midterms. But before that, you just asked me about FTX.
Yeah.
And
I'm fascinated by this, that before we jump into the elections, I mean, I'm following this probably like all your listeners are following this, like a soap opera, right? And like even, yesterday there was SDNY, the attorneys are going to like come after him, or they're the ones that are looking to potentially drop a suit on him. But I'm dying to know how you're looking at this right now.
I mean, first off, there's three levels. There's kind of like the personal drama. You know, he and his girlfriend were running these kind of fraudulent companies. His parents, and I believe her parents, are intimately connected to the government and the administration. And, you know, they donated. They're one of the biggest political donors in history to a political campaign.
At $39 million for Democratic candidates in the 2022 midterm elections. Yes.
And there's starting to be this drama, like, what's the connection between the Ukraine and FTX? Because some of the money that might have been donated to Ukraine has ended up in FTX, supposedly. I don't know. I mean, all this stuff is still coming to light. Like, we don't have a flashlight revealing right. Every aspect of this scandal. Like any scandal, there's layers and layers and layers and then layers. I mean, again, his parents are so politically connected. I mean, his mom runs a $200 million PAC. Where did she get that money from? But all of that aside, there's also the question of what's, even though when I described to you what he did, it's clearly wrong. And you would think to yourself instantly, this is illegal.
Right.
But because he's kind of like in this unregulated Wild West, and I'm not even talking about crypto. I'm talking about he has an exchange in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
So that's completely unregulated. He can make an argument, and I'm sure his lawyers will, that he actually, even though what he did is wrong and he's apologized for it, he didn't actually break a U.S. law. Now, I don't believe that, and I'm sure there are many U.S. laws he broke, but that's the argument they will make. But I'll give you an example of one thing or two things, but however many examples you want, you can find here. But basically, you know, he was running an exchange, and through his girlfriend or sometime girlfriend, he was running a hedge fund. And the hedge fund was investing in all these crappy companies. And at one point, like anything, when the value of the hedge fund goes down, they got a call from the bank and said, hey, you need to put up some more money or else we got to shut you down.
Right.
And, you know, it's called a margin call. We all get margin calls sometimes. But their margin call was for $10 billion. And he simply didn't have it. So he took all the money that was basically in FTX accounts. Like, oh, you know, you're a customer, you put money in, oh, I'm going to buy some Bitcoin. And you think that's safe. It's just being used to buy Bitcoin. No, he took all that money and moved it over to the hedge fund to deal with the bank. And he probably thought, oh, in a week, this will blow over and then I'll move it all back. Well, that was the week that, you know, basically Binance
right.
made this allusion to, he's running out of money, which was true. And everybody, you know, $16 billion worth of people tried to get their money out and he had no money left. He had all the money was in the hedge fund, Alameda. So you can't take all your client money and like put it in your personal garbage can. You have to have the money there for customers just in case they need it. and he didn't have it at that point. So he's basically went $10 billion in the hole immediately, and now he's $16 billion in the hole. So that right there is like grossly illegal. Like if a bank took all of your money, Phil, like and said, hey, we're going to put it in this hedge fund, and then the hedge fund instantly goes out of business, you're screwed. The bank's out of business. But in the U.S., that can't happen. Banks are so heavily regulated,
right?
And they have bailouts from the Federal Reserve. But people seem to think that the FTX was like a bank. No, it was just this little exchange. And I do mean little, you know, $16 billion versus $140 trillion in stock market-based exchanges. Right. So he had this little exchange, but it was in the Bahamas. It's not even in the U.S. So it's unclear what's legal and illegal in the Bahamas. It's a very unregulated, it's the Wild West. So that's one thing he did that's wrong. Here's another thing. Imagine you're a hedge fund, Alameda, that's associated with FTX. You invest the money. I invest in Phil's company. And I tell you, Phil, you need to put all the money in FTX. That's where you have to keep the money that I invest in you. Now, FTX takes that money and invests it back in Alameda so they can invest in more private companies.
Right. But weren't they also creating their own coin?
Well, that's the other thing. Like then they were making their own coin.
Scam coins, because they were just creating them, correct?
Right. This coin had no real value. Now, some coins do have real value backing them. Like you could say Ethereum, people need to use Ethereum to make other projects. So there's a supply and demand, there's value for it. They made this coin FTT, they propped up the value of FTT, put it in Alameda.
They bought it, right? They bought their own coin to prop up the value, correct?
They bought their own coin to prop up the value, and then they use that as collateral to borrow real money from the bank. And so that also has a Ponzi scheme like flavor to it. But again, it's like, what is the law that was broken? A lawyer would know. I don't know. Yeah. It's definitely unethical and wrong. Yeah. And he definitely knew at the time he was doing it that it was wrong. But he probably never thought he would get caught, because there's this feeling that, oh, it's just going to keep going up. And again, this is very similar. And we have a podcast about this coming up in a few days. We compare this to Enron step by step. It's everything Enron did, FTX did. Everything Madoff did, FTX did. Everything Lehman Brothers did, WorldCom, Michael Milken, all of these kind of frauds and weird financial things from the past have the same similar pattern, including FTX.
Yeah, the other one, have you ever listened to the All In podcast?
I've been on it. I've been on Jason Calcanis' show a bunch of times, and he's been on this podcast a bunch of times.
Yeah, so they did a show, I don't know when this our episode's coming out, but they did a show in about Friday, maybe November 11th, and it's utterly fascinating because they break it down about everything you're saying. But that was that was a while ago. Things have changed. Like Sam's now done interviews via Twitter. Like it's just crazy. Anyway, I think you've been thinking about it.
You know, it's very interesting because here's where it's really like Enron. Like the Enron executives, some of them actually decided to go to court. They had a plea bargain. Hey, get 1 year in jail and you're done. But one executive I remember specifically, like the deputy CFO or whatever, he decided to go to court. He knew that what they did was wrong, but he didn't think it was illegal. And he went to court and got 20 years in jail, like because he lost. Because it's hard to say when you're in a new area of financial innovation. Financial innovation is in general good for the world. Like, you know, there was a lot of frauds in the 80s, but junk bonds now are a regular part of financial innovation. That's how companies get funded. That's how innovation happens, is with this new funding. Just like, you know, derivatives on housing, it was a fraudulent when Lehman Brothers was using them, but now it's common things for mutual funds and hedge funds and banks. Hedge funds did not blow up just because Madoff blew up.
Right.
So just like this has nothing really to do with crypto, but this crypto exchange did a lot of illegal or what seems like illegal things, but it's because it's so unregulated. It's just, we know it's wrong. We know what he did was criminal, but criminal in like an adjective sense and not in a legal sense. We don't know. No lawyer knows, which is why lawyers are defending him. Otherwise, you know, nobody would want to defend him he's definitely going to go to jail, but maybe he doesn't get extradited if it's not if he didn't break a law in the Bahamas, he's not going to get extradited is the issue, or maybe disappears. Although I've actually done some work on that, and it's very hard these days, of course, to disappear. It's not even like, you know, back in the Enron WorldCom days, I remember having a discussion with Jim Cramer. One of those executives was trying to disappear and they caught him.
Damn.
I don't know which one.
Huh.
And they couldn't get away with it. But they all went to jail. I mean, Bernie Evers in jail. All the Enron people are in jail except for Ken Lay, who died. Fortunately for him, he died. So Jeff Skilling tried to commit suicide, but ended up, I think he's still in jail.
No,
I
think he ended up getting out, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was in for a long time, though. The All In podcast is David Sachs, Calcanis, I think Chalmuth. It's like four or five of those guys.
And you know what's interesting is David Sachs is, first of all, he was originally with PayPal, and he's one of the biggest investors now in the new Twitter.
He's helping Elon with Twitter right now. So these guys have some interesting, and Chalmuth talks about how SBF came to pitch him and what happened with FTX. So that's another one that's kind of interesting in that interview. Okay, sorry. I just...
One prediction I will make outside of FTX, but related to this, is that Twitter is going to be the ultimate cryptocurrency digital payments platform. Hmm. That's Elon's ultimate goal for Twitter. That's why Twitter is probably, when he brings it public again, it's going to be worth $150 to $200 billion. He bought it for $44, and he's going to take Twitter and turn it into the dream of what FTX would have loved to have been, but wasn't. And that's going to be a huge catalyst where finally people who understand Twitter are going to be able to use cryptocurrencies. So cryptocurrencies, honestly, are too complicated for grandma and grandpa to use. Well, I'm going to use some weird DeFi exchange called Pancake Swap, and I have to keep track of wallets and private keys and passwords, and I'm 97 years old. How am I going to do this? Like, there needs to be a clean interface. Twitter is going to become that interface because of people like, where did David Sachs, Elon Musk, and all these people come from? PayPal, digital payments. Yep. So that, and someone needs to make the interface, the front end to crypto easier, as opposed to this Wild West FTX stuff. Then this FTX stuff won't happen. But Phil Stutz, campaign manager extraordinaire, you were involved in around 100 races in the midterms. You've been working on campaigns since 2004.
Oh, no, 1996.
That was Clinton versus Dole.
Yeah.
Wait, who was Dole's vice presidential candidate then?
Jack Kemp.
Oh, Jack Kemp, yeah. All right, Phil. This election, and by the way, this is not about political issues. For the purposes of this podcast, I could not care less about the political issues. I am a betting man, and I was using predicted.org to bet. I should have taken my bets off or should have.
You made a lot of money before the election. You lost the money after the election, correct?
Yeah, the morning of the election, I was up 30%.
Right.
I could have just had a clean slate instead of...
You got greedy.
It was speculation after that. And so, and everything was close. There was no reason to stay in it after on close elections when I was already up. But obviously, the red wave did not happen as many people expected.
Yeah.
They took over the House. We just learned finally.
Yeah.
They didn't overwhelmingly take it over, and they did not take over the Senate. And so many elections were closer than thought. On the Democrat side, I don't know what surprises there were. I will say I'm disappointed Tim Ryan did not win in Ohio. That was my...
You got crushed.
Anybody who's ever been on this podcast, I support for their office when they run. So Democrat or Republican. And or libertarian, you know. So what happened? No red wave.
Yeah,
let's start with that.
It was more like a pink tide. How about that?
I don't even know if it was a pink tide. Well, no, I mean, they lost.
James,
the Senate.
You're reading every story right now, but the fact is that now the Republicans have control of the House. Joe Biden is not going to get one thing passed in the next 2 years. It's impossible to have that done. So everybody in the Republican world, including me, thought we would pick up between 20 and 40 seats. We're going to end up picking up about 8, right? That's not what people thought, but that's also an expectation game. The bottom line is, did you get majority of the House, right? You didn't get the majority of the Senate, and you lost some key governor's races, and Democrat incumbents pretty much won every single race in the Senate. Across the board, and governor races across the board. Let me give you another example of this. In 2020, it was predicted that Republicans would lose their, lose like crazy in the Senate and in the House, and the presidential race would, it was a 50-50 toss-up. That ended up happening. Republicans actually, they were supposed to lose like 25 seats, according to all the prediction markets. They ended up winning about 8 seats. I can't remember the exact number, but around that. That was unprecedented. And we all patted each other on the back and thought, my gosh, that is, we stopped that tide. We did that on the Republican side, right? And then we realized, well, the Democrats are still in power. They control the committees. They control the investigations. They control everything. It doesn't matter if it's a one-vote majority or a 40-vote majority. They're still in the charge. And then we've had to spend 2 years dealing with that on the Republican side. So what I'm saying is, totally agree. It was not the expectation. I'm never going to sugarcoat anything. But the fact that the Republicans did get the majority in the House is a big deal. It is. And the majority, for the first time, like in, oh my God, decades, the Republicans won the popular vote in the midterms. That never happens. So,
oh, is that true? So, yeah. What that means, out of all the votes cast for Congress, if you add them all up, Congress and Senate, if you add them all up, there were more Republican voters than Democrat
right now
voters.
It's around 5 million, but California is still counting. Here we are like 10, 12 days after the election. So that number will probably come down a little bit, but the bottom line is they did. So there was some, let me just say this. Let me back up. It was the most, it was the weirdest election I've ever been a part of in, 26 years of elections. I've never seen.
Why is that?
I mean, I can give you, I'll straight up give you all the reasons the Democrats won, but Republicans gained something like 19 points with Hispanics. 19 points with Hispanics. They gained 5 points nationally with African Americans. So there's a realignment that's happening. And this is what I think is ultimately the outcome. You're seeing purple states are states that can go Republican or Democrat, and they are either going more red or they're going more blue. And you're seeing, Lee Zeldin ran for governor. We talked about this in the last podcast. Lee Zeldin ran for governor of New York, right? And he lost by about 300,000 votes, which sounds like a lot, but if you think about the state of New York, that's actually not that many.
Yeah, and for New York, by the way, just to underscore, right. I mean, they had a Republican governor with George Pataki in the late 90s, but they've been 100% Democrat. Like the last Republican, the last governor election, Andrew Cuomo won by 90% to nothing.
Yeah. So if but there's this realignment where so many people left New York. You should write an article about that. But that so many people left New York that it's
no thanks.
It is just so many people left California that the only people that are left, or a lot of the people that are left, right, from a statewide, not a house district wide, it's just becoming more blue. And even in an election like this, if you would have taken the same congressional map from 2018, so the census creates a new congressional map across the country, right? Some states may lose a congressional seat, some may gain based on population. There are new lines drawn. It's all been done in the last 2 years. If you take the map that was in place in 2018, Republicans would have won 20 seats on election day this year. That's crazy, right? They ended up winning, 6, 8 seats. But my point is that if you would have just taken the same congressional map from 4 years ago, Republicans would have picked up 20 seats. So there's a lot of reasons why that is. Each state does their own census tracking and then redraws their own lines and all this stuff. But my point is that it's going to be harder for Republicans going forward to make, I think in like 2010, 2014, Republicans picked up massive, can't remember if it was 10 or 14, but they picked up something like 65 seats, right? That's insane. But the way the congressional lines are drawn now, I don't think that kind of wave is happening again. And in a way, that's probably why we missed it a little bit, but on the Congress side, because we thought this was going to be a 25 to 35 seat win or a shift with the Republicans. But the way the congressional lines are drawn now, it's just not possible.
And in the Senate, of course, that's state by state. There's no congressional lines drawn. Exactly. I mean, there's no senatorial lines drawn. So let's start with the Senate, because the Senate was the biggest surprise. There was not okay, maybe there was really not even a pink tide. The Senate sort of remained the same, just maybe with different actors.
No, the Republicans right now, if Herschel Walker wins the runoff in Georgia, Republicans lost one seat.
Yeah. Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, there's so many questions. The first one is, when we spoke last, you said the issues in order were, if I remember correctly, you know, inflation / economy, crime, immigration, abortion.
Yes.
Was that order correct? Like, did people vote on the basis of those issues?
So, great question. Here is what happened in the data that we've been looking at. These were their number one issues, but it wasn't their deciding issue going into the polls. Their deciding issues came down to the fact that Trump came into a lot of these states at the last minute, and it brought out a lot of angst in the voters that went, we like Trump policies, but this is a scary world we're in right now with pandemics and wars and inflation and recession. And they want something that's totally stable and serious. And in the end, they reverted back to what they know versus making another upheaval of change. And that had there were two reasons why. One was, if you look at the data, the Trump endorsed candidates that were talking about election denialism tended to perform about 5 points below the Republican candidates that just ran on their own issues. 5 points. That would have swung the Senate, because you would have won, you could have won potentially Pennsylvania. That was about a 4.7 margin. You definitely would have won Nevada with Adam Laxalt. You would have had a chance with Blake Masters, would have been a lot closer. The Herschel Walker race. So the Republicans would have had the Senate on that. The abortion issue, which I told you, I didn't feel like it was such a big issue, these inflation issues, it just, it amplified that people don't want a lot of crazy change. They're fine with the abortion issue right now. On average, the majority of people, they don't want, you know, let me give you an example of where the abortion issue really played, the state of Michigan. So they had a ballot measure, like an abortion ballot measure, right? That eliminating abortion, right? Not only did Tudor Dixon lose to Gretchen Whitmer, the governor's race, which we thought was going to be super close, it ended up being a blowout. But the state house and the state senate went to the majority of Democrats for the first time since 1982.
Wow.
Why?
That's a big
why. Because you had the abortion issue on the ballot. On the ballot. And so, you know, these states also felt this. So again, if you look at independents, and about 13% of Republicans out of, you know, 100%, they were like, we like Trump policies. We like the Republican policies. We want them to come in and fix inflation. But there's just too much uncertainty in the world right now. And I believe that Trump went into 16 competitive races in the last couple of weeks, and or maybe he went to 18, and 16 of those candidates lost. It says something.
Oh my gosh. So, and we'll talk about that in the context of Trump's announcement for a presidency, but
Trump won 2 of 16 competitive races in which he did rallies in the last few weeks. And there's more, because you called out something in our first podcast back in September, and I dismissed it. And I was wrong. And that was the money that was spent by Democrats versus Republicans. And it mattered. Let me give you, and you brought this specific one up. And I look back on it now and I went, man, James was totally right there. In Arizona, in the U.S. Senate race between Mark Kelly and Blake Masters, Mark Kelly raised $81.8 million. Just his candidates, just his campaign. Do you know how much Blake Masters raised?
I think it was something like $10, $15
million. $12.1 million. $12.1. So we're talking almost $70 million more spent against you. He got crushed for this. I mean, I'm telling you. And so when you wrap those things together, the voters did care about inflation. All these issues I told you about. Listen, we've never seen, it's called the trifecta. It's like unpopular president, bad economy, and it's just one other. I forgot it last time too, but it's like inflation or
war.
Or what was that?
War.
No, it wasn't war, but it's one other. But if you've measured these three factors in every election in the last 40 years, it is a monumental wave for the party that doesn't reflect those three factors, right? And it didn't happen. Well, one more thing.
Yeah.
On the money thing. So this is the disparity between Mark Kelly and Blake Masters was bigger than pretty much every other Senate race in the country. But the pattern was the same. Republican candidates got way, way outraised and spent on. Now, what I argued back in September was, yes, but we're making up for it because we're raising a lot of money on the super PAC side. But one thing in my brain fog of campaigns that I just totally forgot about was, if you go to a TV station or you're going to buy ads in the digital space with like Roku or Hulu, right? There is a candidate rate and then there is a super PAC rate. And the super PAC rate is almost 8 to 10 times more expensive than the candidate rate. So while Blake Masters may have had $30 million spent on his behalf by a super PAC, the efficiency of Mark Kelly's $81 million plus all the super PAC money he had versus Blake Masters' $12 million was, I mean, it's outrageous how the difference in that, right? And so therefore, when you see that across the board, and this is just a fact. This is not like excuses. Like, this also contributed. They got, the Republicans are to blame. The Republicans not raising enough money is to blame. Like,
what's their issue with raising money? Like, do they not have their fundraising machine in place? Or, you know, why were the Democrats able to raise so much more money than Republicans?
Well, they do a better job of fundraising, for one. And the other is that they have this thing called Act Blue. Are you familiar with Act Blue?
No.
So if you see any kind of ad right now for a Democrat that's trying to raise money, you probably are seeing Ralph Warnock stuff in Georgia. Let's say it's Barack Obama saying, hey, this is Barack Obama. You know, click here, help Warnock. It's one database that every Democratic candidate in the world or in America, right, opts into. And people in California or Alaska can see Barack Obama and go, hey, I want to help Barack Obama, or I want to help Ralph Warnock. And a portion of that goes through. I mean, they have one central database that allows them to collect money from millions of people in small donor donations. Now, they created this database back in like 2012, 2014. And that is how they operate. It is the foundation of their entire party. The Republicans were slow on the take. So we have one, it's called Win Red, but it really didn't come out until 2020 or maybe even 2018. And it's still in its infancy stage. And Republican donors aren't as familiar with the fact that they can make small dollar donations and they get spread out among all the candidates in different ways, that it's just not institutionalized like the Democrats have done. And kudos to them, because they've built a machine.
So let's look at like two races that were side by side, and one was a blowout red. The other ended up being not a blowout, but it ended up being blue. Pennsylvania and Ohio. J.D. Vance, you know, author of the great book Hillbilly Elegy, which became a movie. You know, he was the Republican candidate versus Tim Ryan, who had previously run for president. He had run for speaker against Nancy Pelosi. All around, he'd written a book on meditation, which is odd for someone in the Congress. And then on Pennsylvania, you had Dr. Oz, celebrity TV guy, who's been on this podcast, versus Fetterman. Why were those races side by side, Pennsylvania borders Ohio, why were they so different?
Money.
I mean, so Tim Ryan, who is a much more establishment figure, he raised less money than Fetterman, who essentially, yes. You know.
A couple things. I'm happy to walk this. First of all, J.D. Vance actually was more competitive on the money side with super PACs coming in. They got J.D. Vance got a ton more money than Blake Masters. So in the end, he had the money to go make the argument. Plus, Ohio is a much, this is one of those purple states that has turned red, right? It's, it is just, it is increasingly turning red. It was red for Trump twice, and it is increasingly going red. And one good, you know, we can talk about the Democrats have a lot of defense races in 2024. One of them is Sherrod Brown, who is the U.S. Senator, Democratic Senator from Ohio. And that is a potential huge pickup for Republicans in 2024. Pennsylvania is purple and trending blue. And what we're seeing in the data is that half of the votes for Fetterman had already come before his debate, his infamous debate.
Because when did they open up the polls in Pennsylvania? Like two weeks before?
The exact dates, but they have, you know, they have a very open, early, you know, vote by mail, all these kind of things. And it's instant. That's another thing that we haven't talked about. The early voting for Democrats is an institutionalized way to vote for Democrats. And it used to be that Republicans were very organized in absentee voting, early voting as well. But in 2020, Donald Trump told Republicans, don't trust that. You need to vote on election day. And that's been a huge, huge impediment on Republicans, because we're now like, this thing has to get solved. We have to get into the early vote game, and we have to convince Republican voters to bank those votes early and not rely on election day, where they may be distracted and not vote.
You know, it's a very interesting thing, because like when I was younger, absentee voting was exactly that, absentee voting. So ballots were sent to military people who were overseas, or were sent to other people who specifically requested one because, hey, I'm not going to be in the state on election day. Mm-hmm. Now, absentee ballots are sent to everybody in the state. And like you say, the people are encouraged to vote early. And one side, the Democrats, have kind of used this as a strategy, whereas the Republicans have ignored it.
They've ignored it in some places. Mm-hmm. In the state of Florida, we have early voting, and it's not an issue, you know. But we also have, you have to show your ID, you know, when you show up at the polls, and they got rid of this ballot harvesting and you know, drop box locations. Nope, you just show up at the location and you early vote and you show your ID.
What's the issue with ballot harvesting?
Do you know what ballot harvesting is?
It's I'm assuming it's what you just said, but I've heard the term.
Yeah, no, it's basically a party representative. So somebody from the Democratic Party runs around and collects people's ballots that aren't related to them or whatever, right? So there are a lot of concerns on the Republican side that there's some nefarious stuff going on that. That you've got party operatives running around collecting hundreds and thousands of ballots and then dumping them at a site. And that, you know, without showing ID, those votes have not had an ID verification or anything. That's where Republicans are the most concerned. Now Republicans are like, oh, okay, well, if that's the game and we can't get the laws changed, then we're going to play the game too. And it doesn't mean cheating. It just means they're going to start implementing sort of ballot harvesting campaigns. And so we're going to see where that goes, but that's where the problem is. So in Florida, there is no ballot harvesting. There are no drop boxes.
Well, why? It's illegal, or
yeah,
what's the story in Florida?
Ron DeSantis, you know, after 2020 sort of cleaned up and said, had a pretty, you know, strict, this is how we're going to do it. You can vote early. I voted early in Florida. I voted, you know, 10 days early. And here, you know, like in Florida, you know, like, It was the biggest, DeSantis was win, was the biggest blowout by a Republican statewide elected office holder in the history of the state's elections, right? He won by 19 points. It's insane. He won Miami-Dade, which Hillary Clinton won by something like 40 points in 2016. And DeSantis won the county, which is, you know, one of the biggest counties.
Yeah, that's odd, because that's a very blue,
very blue
county. Right. It's the only blue county, I think, in Florida.
He won Puerto Ricans. He won Cubans. He split Mexican, or non-Puerto Rican, non-Cuban vote. He got 50%. The numbers that came out of Florida from that perspective, I have it: 58% of Hispanics voted for him, 50% of non-Cuban, non-Puerto Rican, 56% of Puerto Ricans voted for him, 70% of Hispanics in Miami-Dade voted for him. So
why do you think that is? Because that's typically not counting Cuban. Cubans historically have been Republican because they don't like Castro, and you know they don't like the fact that Barack Obama initiated relations with Cuba. But like, what's the deal with kind of Mexicans in Miami? They hated the immigration laws of Trump, like that. They were permanently hating on that. So how did he get 70% of the votes of those people?
So this goes into probably the ultimate reason of the elections. Brand matters. Brand matters. They like DeSantis. If you look at every candidate that ran on sort of disputing the 2020 elections, every one of those candidates lost. And again, on average, they finished 5% below, on average, 5% below Republicans that ran on issues.
And that didn't Dr. Oz run on issues in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, but he was at the Trump rally the day, you know, 2 days before the election. Carrie Lake, who I thought was a shoo-in, you know, did a rally with Steve Bannon the last 3 days of the election. So, wow. I mean, again, she has the right to endorse and have any supporter she wants, but you already, in Arizona, Carrie Lake, she already had that vote. Like, go, you gotta win the new votes, the votes that you need to get you over the top. And so the brand problem in the party, you know, we're seeing a shift in our part in the Republican Party right now, because you're about to see, you know, leading into 2024, what direction that party wants to go.
So it's interesting. What we're kind of saying, and what you're kind of saying, is that issues, of all the factors in an election, issues really aren't the most important thing, because it doesn't matter what the important issues are to people. At some point deep down, they're either scared or not scared. And if they're scared, they're going to vote against, you know, what they're afraid of. And if they're not scared, they're probably going to, you know, maybe then the issues are more important. But in general, right now, people are scared. And one of the things they're scared of is Trump's rhetoric they might like his policies, but his rhetoric was so polarizing, they just don't want to return to that. And because that polarization is maybe linked to all the troubles we're having now. They don't know. They're just scared of it. And
there's so much chaos, they just want less chaos. How about that?
And then the other thing is,
there's so much chaos in the world. I mean, whether it's war, inflation, recession, you know, pandemic, all that stuff. That, like, it's like, can we just have something that's just not chaos that we want? Even if, like, I don't agree with the Democrat policies of inflation or spending or pandemic or war. At the same time, the overriding concern came in as, we just want a little stability. And this is, you know, ultimately, this is probably the argument that Biden made in 2020, right? I'm going to restore sort of that, I don't know, stability. That was his argument. Whether you think he did or not, I don't know. But I think in comparison to what they saw leading into the last days of that election, I think the whole election, you know, it was interesting. You asked me a very important question when we talked about a week before the election. You said, what would I be most concerned about? And I said, well, what I'd be most concerned about is the fact that all these polls came out saying the Republicans were going to crush Democrats, but it came out 19 days before the election, not 3 days before the election. Because when you have 19 days before the election, you've got 19 days for things to change. You remember this?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if Trump had just stayed home those 19 days, do you think things would have been different?
I think it could have factored in for sure. But the fact is that 19 days gave Democrats more opportunity to bank early votes and to get their operation solidified and to win the messaging war in the last few weeks. And what we saw, so like after we talked for that last 7 days before the election, the one thing I kept seeing was all these
all these polling numbers we were looking at internally that, you know, I think Carrie Lake had been consistent, and let's just take her for example in Arizona. She'd been consistently winning by about 5 or 6 or 7 points. And then all of a sudden in the last 2 or 3 days, like 3 polls came out and she was up 1. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense at all. Like, and I even remember you and I talked also that the New York Times and Siena College had a poll out. What was the outlier poll of the whole election, right? They were saying Democrats are going to hold the Senate. They were saying that, you know, certain Democrats were up big, that we had Republicans either tied or up a little bit. Maybe, I think we talked about this, but I said, they're the one outlier. And if they're right, they're going to be like, and they were. They were the right poll. They were. They saw a trend changing and happening. One of the things that I relied on and looked at a lot of data with was the Trafalgar Group. You remember what we talked about them a little bit? And we talked about this submerged Trump voter this cycle. Well, that wasn't even there. It didn't even exist. They were totally wrong. But they had been completely right and the only people right for 2 elections. And so I think they doubled down on this hidden Trump voter. Well, Trump wasn't on the ballot for Republicans, but he was on the ballot for Democrats and independents.
That's so interesting.
And independents.
And so it turns out basically the Trump issue trumped all the other issues, not to be punny about that, but now, and then the other
the only thing I'd say is I'd say it was a factor. I think candidate quality was probably number one. I think less, you know, chaos in a world of chaos was a factor. I think abortion was a factor, and ultimately when you add all those things and put a bow on it, they overrode inflation, unpopularity of Biden, and all of those other things.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match 2 of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Was candidate quality an issue? And I'm just speaking in terms of resume and again, not the issues itself, but like Tim Ryan to me in Ohio was probably more qualified to serve his state than J.D. Vance. But in Pennsylvania, you know, the opposite might be true, mm-hmm. which is Mehmet Oz might have been more qualified than Fetterman to be in the Senate. And, you know, probably Warnock is certainly more qualified than Walker to be in the Senate. But that's still going to be a runoff. That was really close. So we're seeing 3 different outcomes based on quality. And I don't know if quality was an issue. And Blake Masters is
again,
super, super
James,
qualified
you're,
as
you're
well.
Looking at it from an apples to apples comparison. It's not. Ohio is a much more Republican state than Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is a blue state. Ohio is a red state. Georgia right. is a purple state. You have to factor that in. It's not the same to compare them. There's no comparison to those states. And the fact is that J.D. Vance is a really good candidate. Now, he also embraced Trump.
Don't get me wrong. I like J.D. Vance, too, as an author.
He is one of the few that embraced Trump, and he won, right? So that should tell you about how red Ohio has gone. And Pennsylvania, Mastriano was running for governor. He got destroyed in the governor's race, right? So it's a blue state.
Yeah. And so
you have to run differently in each of these states.
And it also seemed like what you're saying is the big issues were this ballot these sort of under the surface issues, which is ballot harvesting, whether a campaign did that or not, and these new techniques for raising money. And I feel like the Democrats have always been a little bit ahead of Republicans since the 90s. The Republicans were better in the 90s, I think, at raising money. Now the Democrats with you know, Obama put together a really good machine starting in 2008, and the Democrats have become a better money-raising machine than the Republicans.
Yeah.
And this has become major issues in the past couple elections. And but you're also saying that, look, the Republicans won the House, which still means a gridlock gridlocked government, which is really what kind of I think many people were voting for gridlock, right? Because
it brings
in general the economy tends to,
right?
Yeah. And I just want to say one issue economically that's very important, which is that when you don't have government gridlock and the government ends up having control over a lot of programs and spending a lot of money, then the government is paying more people money, and the taxes it generates is from money they're paying. This is why you need a large private economy. You don't want the government to be the biggest part of the economy, because then the tax revenues they get are just their own money recycled. You can't pay people and then have it come back as taxes to the government and just keep repeating that. You need money outside the government in order to really make new money from taxes. And that's what a lot of people forget. So gridlock is good because it means less government programs will be started and so on. So
let me give you the greatest example of what I'm talking about with what I'd call a purple state, a 50-50 state. All right, we got Arizona, mm-hmm. right? Now we talked about Carrie Lake, we talked about Blake Masters, okay? But think about this. In Arizona, there are 9 congressional seats in Arizona, right? 3 are strong Democrat-leaning, 3 are strong Republican-leaning, and then 3 are toss-ups. Okay. In Arizona, the 3 toss-ups went to Republicans. The 3 Republican seats stayed Republican. The 3 Democratic seats stayed a Democrat. So you have you basically have a 6-3 majority in the House, where it could, you know, there's 3 seats that could go either way. The GOP won the treasurer's race in the state treasurer's race. Okay. That candidate was not talking about the elections of 2020. The attorney general it's like right now it hadn't been decided. It's like 500 votes. He's down 500 votes. They could possibly win the Secretary of Education, which again, not running on 2020. So if you look at those, and all of these candidates finished about on average about 5 points higher than, you know, Blake Masters. Now, Carrie Lake basically tied. I mean, she's, you know, barely down. She lost, right? But even she finished with less votes than the treasurer running in the state. Now, the treasurer is a well-known woman. I think her last name is Yee, but she's a well-known woman, and she's run statewide before, and people know who she is. And so this is a fascinating thing. Like, when you want to know, like, that's more of an apples and apples comparison, okay? Because you're looking at a state that there a lot of Republicans won and a lot of Republicans lost. So what was the difference? And therein lies where I'm talking about.
So basically, the ones that were talking about a 2020 thing, the election denialism,
hold on. I'm going to push back on election denialism, because you've got literally about 1,000 different Democrats over the last 20 years who have said that certain Republican presidents weren't legitimate and that elections were going to be stolen. And we don't call them deniers either.
Right.
So
that's true. That's a really good point.
These are people that disputed the 2020 elections. You can yell at me and say, oh, that's BS. I don't care. But I mean, there are plenty of Democrats that have done the exact same thing. So these are people that disputed the 2020 elections, whether I agree with that or not, which I don't. I don't think, I think there was manipulation by the media. I think there was manipulation by the social media platforms in 2020, but I do not think there was mass election fraud on election day. And so my point ultimately is the people that ran on that are the ones in Arizona who are not winning right now.
It's so interesting. So Okay, let's look at the this congressional race that's still not decided. Lauren Boebert. Now, she was an extreme January 6th. You know, she tweeted out, like, this is 1776 all over again, you know, on January 6th. And at first, it was reported that she lost. Now, I think she's winning. It's not decided yet.
Yeah, she's up about 500 votes. And they're actually counting disputed ballots right now.
What was her story? Like, she was an extreme, like, kind of crazy, you know, January 6th person. And what's... You would think someone like that would be so polarizing.
I believe it's an either Trump won the district by either 8 or 13 points.
Right. So people are really turning against people who just campaign on that issue are a little crazy. I mean,
here's the thing. The voters right now want stability and how we sort of get our economy back on track, how we put all these social issues behind us, how we, you know, resolve the financial issues and the pandemic issues and all this stuff. They just want to look forward. And when a candidate, you know, I'll give you another example. I worked for John Thune, who ran for the U.S. Senate in 2002.
South Dakota.
And he lost by about 329 votes out of about 330,000 cast. 329 votes to the incumbent U.S. Senator named Tim Johnson. I was on that race. I lived in South Dakota for a year. It was one of the, like, imagine spending a year of your life, no days off. I'm talking no days off, and then losing by 329 votes out of 330,000 cast.
Did you cry?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the most PTSD I have, right? But the one, you know, we don't think about the wins, we think about the losses more than we think about the wins, and this one is the one I'll never forget. When it was over, all the Republican lawyers flew into South Dakota. We were all sitting around. How are we going to do a recount? How are we going to dispute this? What are we going to do? We knew that there had been a little bit of election fraud in some counties that were doing ballot harvesting before it was legal. And hey, we had a case to make. And John Thune came in and he sat down and he said, I don't want to fight this. I'm going to concede because this is what's best for the country. And frankly, I don't know if I could win even if I fought, you know, this. And so before he even got to that recount or that fight, he literally came out, congratulated Senator Johnson on a win, and said he'd fight another day. 2 years later, John Thune decides to challenge the incumbent Senator Tom Daschle, who's the Senate Majority Leader in the United States Senate, and he wins. And he wins by 10,000 votes. And he did it because he preserved his reputation, because the voters just didn't want to get bogged down in the election was stolen thing. I'm telling you, I've lived through this. Voters are ready to move on. Whether it happened or whether it didn't, they're ready to move on, and they want to know how you're going to solve the future problems and the current problems, not dispute past arguments. And that's what
it's very interesting because history repeats itself, right? Or what's the saying? History doesn't repeat it, but it rhymes. 1960, John F. Kennedy versus Richard Nixon, very close race. Most of Nixon's advisors were saying, hey, John F. Kennedy, there's at least some suspicious votes in Chicago, which was a turning state, right? Illinois. And everybody was advising Nixon to contest it. And behind the scenes, he did have lawyers mobilized and he was contesting it, but he did concede on election night. And he was, I don't want to say a gracious loser, but he admitted he lost. And then, of course, 2 years later, he lost for governor of California. He admitted he lost. And then, you know, 1968, it's a very good lesson. If you stay above the mud, you always have a chance to come back. Right. If you stay in the mud, you'll always look like mud.
So if you're just looking at the 2024 polling right now, the script has completely flipped. And every poll that has come out since Election Day, and just a couple, you know, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, every single race, Ron DeSantis is now beating Donald Trump. Every single one. Every single one. And all these states. I'm talking state-specific ones, not national. So why? Because they go, hey, we want to be with the winner. We want to be with the person that gets us there, right? That's what's happening. Now, don't count Trump out. I mean, my God, the guy, every time you count him out, he comes back, right? And so what that looks like. And again, there's just a realignment going on in the Republican Party. And unfortunately, Republicans are going to have to go through some painful moments while this realignment's happening. And it could be a good realignment, could be a bad realignment. I don't know. But it's an interesting realignment that's going on right now.
You know, it's also interesting. There's a realignment happening in terms of age. Like, first off, when we talk about the 2024 elections, a lot of people don't even mention Joe Biden, who's, since he's the president, he's the obvious potential nominee for 2024. But people are constantly asking about Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, who's the governor of California, and so on. Joe Biden's like 80 years old. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi and the current Democratic majority leader and the current Democratic majority whip are all resigning their leadership positions. They're all, respectively, Nancy Pelosi is 82 years old. The leader is 83 years old. The whip is 82 years old. Like, all the 80-year-olds are leaving their leadership posts and probably eventually leaving, I mean, Congress in the next year or so. So what's going to happen on the Democratic side? Is the AOC wing going to take over, or will there be younger, kind of middle of the road? I don't want to say Pelosi's totally middle of the road, but she's at least not as extreme left. I never like the extremes. So AOC is an extreme, and Ilhan Omar is an extreme. Like, that group is an extreme. Do you think the progressive wing will take over of the Democrats, or you think that's going to stay kind of quasi-middle?
I don't know. I mean, Omar and AOC got less votes in this election than they did in previous elections. So if they're looking at just their own districts, then you would say that they would come back, swing back towards the middle a little bit. Whether they do or not, I don't know. I think everything kind of comes down to, like, I think when you're in the minority, which the Democrats will be in the House, you're going to see more extremism come on their end, because they're going to have louder voices and more outrage over the fact that Republicans are blocking legislation or won't take up legislation or investigating Hunter Biden, or they'll find outrage that kind of can mask their policy beliefs. When they're in the majority, they don't have outrage, so they have to be upfront with their policy beliefs. So this is what you'll see. How that unfolds, though, I just don't know.
Yeah, and it's going to be very interesting for 2024. Like, I think the worst outcome is that we have another Trump-Biden race. But, you know, just because A, it's boring, and B, they're 80 years old. Like, everybody's got to relax at some point. Like, why do people still want to be president at the age of 80? I hope when I'm 80, I don't want to be anything. Like, why there's so much ambition at that age when it's an age where you should spend with your grandchildren and focus on, you know, being a mentor to younger people and so on. So, but let's say 2024, another possible outcome is Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, versus Ron DeSantis. Now, the Democrats are going to have a problem, because if Biden doesn't run, Kamala, of course, will run. She's an ambitious woman.
Yep.
She ran in 2020. Gavin Newsom doesn't want to run against her. They're good friends. He's already said he's not going to run if she runs. So this point,
yeah, I don't believe that. But okay, keep
going. So you think he'll run against her?
Oh God, he's the most ambitious politician hands down in the country.
All right, so let's say hypothetically then, since I don't know what other Democrats are in the potential running, like, what other Democrats are potentially going to run?
Oh, we talked about this, Buttigieg.
I don't think he could win.
You just asked me who else would run.
Yeah.
So
you're right. He's a name.
You may see, then there'll be the outlier candidates. You know, the Tim Ryans of a couple years ago. There'll be a bunch of those who shakes out in that route, in that sort of base. I don't know.
Do you think we could have more than a third part, more than a two party system? I mean, now we're talking about Andrew Yang, Tulsi Gabbard, Liz Cheney. They've all considered independent runs.
And James Altucher.
James Altucher is on the ballot, or he's not on the ballot, but he's a write in candidate, right, according to the FEC. Do you think we could have some of these, you think that we could have a legit third party?
Yeah, I think we're as close as we've ever been.
Although, you know, 1992, Perot was pretty legit third party candidate. I mean, there was one point where he was even winning in the polls.
He was. He also spent, you know, I don't know, $100 million of his own money. So if you're
1980, John Anderson,
yep,
versus Reagan and Carter, he got like a decent percentage in the polls. Yeah, he didn't win any state.
I think you're going to have to find somebody that's willing to put their own money on. Because otherwise, it's like, you and let me liken it to the terms you probably know. It's like a startup company that no one really believes in, but thinks it's a good idea, right? How much funding is that going to get?
So it does boil down to money at that level.
It does.
And so, okay, let's just say then Gavin Newsom versus Ron DeSantis. What's going to, and I know it's very early to say this, but 2 years is not that far away now. People are starting to, I'm sure DeSantis and Newsom are putting together their organizations now. And they're, you know, DeSantis is definitely running.
First of 100% all, Ron chance. DeSantis won by a bigger margin in Florida than Gavin Newsom won in the state of California. That's crazy.
So that's telling.
That's crazy.
Yeah, because California is so blue, whereas realistically, Florida has gone back and forth over the decades.
It is very much used to be a purple state, but the realignment with a good brand being Governor DeSantis, that's a good brand, right? And that realignment that's happened in the state because of him, plus the people moved here during the pandemic and then went, oh my gosh, this guy actually lets my kids go to school and they don't have to wear masks and I can vacation here and go out to a restaurant. And like people felt that. That's a great brand. I mean, that is a great brand.
And he's, of course, completely distanced himself from Trump.
Right. And now, you know, Trump is already starting to go after him and Governor Youngkin in Virginia as well. It's another one. So, you know, my advice is just stay out of it. Don't engage until you're ready to be an alternative to his candidacy, which doesn't have to be right now. But it's going to be interesting to see how that happens. But, we have a really good brand in this party, in the Republican Party. And we have a couple really good brands in the party. So it is going to be interesting to see what voters end up doing rather than what they say in polls.
So, you know, it's interesting, like, in the Republicans, what about Dan Crenshaw? He used to be such a presence, and I have not heard one peep from him in 2 years.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. He's just fallen off the radar. He's fallen off. I think he embraced Ukraine, and he embraced the World Economic Forum in some instances, and I think that really turned off a lot of the Republican base on him.
Yeah, and so, you know, the other thing is, here's one interesting thing. This is the one good thing I would say about forgetting issues aside and just kind of the rhetoric of this. The one interesting thing about Trump's candidacy, even in 2016, is that everyone always says they don't want another politician to be in office. And one thing about Trump and his and the people he got running, whether you like them or not, J.D. Vance, Dr. Oz, Herschel Walker, Blake Masters, none of these people are politicians. And it turns out that people actually do want politicians.
I think message overrode whether it was a politician or a business person.
Yeah. Yeah, because everyone always says, people campaign on it. For hundreds of years, people campaign on, let's drain the swamp. Let's get rid of Washington, D.C., Even Jimmy Carter and the Democrats, he was sort of an unknown. Right. He was like a one-term or two-term. He was a governor of Georgia that nobody knew about. He won in 1976, beating all of the establishment candidates. I'm trying to think of it. Well, Trump is certainly another example on the Republican side.
Absolutely.
Barack Obama is almost an example. He was really only a senator for 2 years before he became president, or 4 years before he became president. And Eisenhower was an example on the Republican side. So, it'll be interesting to see, for 2024, we'll have two governors, but governors in general are not in Washington, D.C. This is why governors traditionally have been elected president more than senators have been. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah. Man, it's endless fun over the next 2 years because we're only basically 13, 14 months from, early voting or voting in the presidential primary. So,
Who are you going to vote for? Who are you going to work for? You're going to probably work for some presidential candidates.
We will.
Do you work for more than one?
We're already in discussions. Obviously, I can't discuss that, but we're in discussions with a couple right now.
What does a campaign manager make, roughly, for a presidential campaign?
Well, I wouldn't be a campaign manager. We'd be an outside media consultant.
Yeah, what does a campaign manager make, though?
Maybe $250. Right, $250.
Really? They don't get extra though for like raising money, a percentage of money raised, anything like that.
I always had win bonuses in my contracts, you know, that were pretty lucrative. And you know, the candidate looks at that and goes, "Yeah, what do I have to lose? I'll have the money if I win. So yeah, I'll pay you a huge bonus." So it's kind of how you kind of, you know, triple up or double up.
And did you get some good win bonuses in these midterm elections?
We got some good win bonuses. Yeah. Look, we worked on four races that decided the House and that we won all four. We were involved in Oregon 5. It was the only race in the state of Oregon that actually had a Republican win. It was Lori Chavez Dreamer. California 13, there's a guy named John Duarte. He's up like 800 votes. We were on the New York 17 race, which was Patrick Mahoney. Do you remember? Did you read about this one? He was the head of the Democratic Campaign Committee.
Yeah, yeah. I was once considering running against him in 2014. That was my district.
Okay.
And he wasn't from the district. Right. And he was I thought he was going to be a one-term guy. Clinton was supporting him, and Clinton was going through like his own Me Too kind of thing. So I thought he was potentially weak, but of course, you know, I didn't run. I didn't feel like it, but
yeah, well, that's the first time in 48 years the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Party lost. So that was a pretty big win for us. We also did John Sununu in New Hampshire, which, you know, they had a competitive U.S. Senate race and all that. In the Senate race, the Republican got destroyed, but Sununu won 57% of the vote. You know, so look, if the House is a 3 or 4 vote majority, you know, we worked on probably four of probably the top 8 races in all of the U.S. House races, and we won all 4. So we feel really good about what we did in the cycle. We had one bad loss. That would be we were on the Laxalt. We were helping on the Laxalt race in Nevada, the U.S. Senate race. But
is that race definitely over? Like, because I know
he's conceded. He lost by, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 out of 1,000,000. I mean, it was basically even. So, we're pretty excited about where we were.
Well, Phil, thank you for the lowdown on this race. It was interesting how the importance of ballot harvesting and the money machine and the distancing from Trump, and also your insights into 2024. So a lot's going to happen between now and 2024. I expect you'll come on quite a few times and keep educating us on the election process. Anything else you thought that was particularly fascinating or interesting in these midterm elections?
No, I would just say the 2024 U.S. Senate races are going to be the most exciting to watch, because there are zero Senate incumbent Republicans running in states that Joe Biden won. And there are 3 senators on the Democratic side that Trump won in 16 and 20. There's Joe Manchin in West Virginia. There's John Tester in Montana. And there's Sherrod Brown in Ohio. So there's 3, if it's a 50-49 or 51-49 or, you know, whatever it is, 51-40, whatever the Senate ends up being after the Herschel runoff, there's a really good chance for Republicans to win in 2024, but they have to have a great candidate on the ballot too, right? And then the Dems have to defend the Arizona Senate race, Senate races in Arizona, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Nevada. These are all close states. They're all having these are all defenses. So opportunities for Republicans to pick up the Senate exist. It just depends on what happens in the presidential race as well.
Well, Phil, again, we'll have you back on to talk about those, because, again, I'm a betting man. I lost all my bets this time, but I super appreciate you coming on the podcast and the show. And we did this one live, so I hope listeners enjoyed it. And good luck in everything you do, Democrat and Republican.
Thanks, man.
Before we go, that's one question from the YouTube for you.
Okay.
It's for Phillips. So Easy Money asks, does DeSantis have a legitimate shot to beat Trump? And if he does, will the wounds of the primary be too much for the general elections?
No. Does he have a chance? Does he have a competitive chance to beat Trump? Absolutely. Oh my gosh. 100%. Would those wounds hurt him against Trump? No. Unless Trump just decides to go nuclear after a primary loss for the rest of the campaign. And if he decides to back the person he lost, if he loses to that, if he decides to back DeSantis and support him, it won't hurt him at all.
Yeah, what if Trump doesn't back DeSantis after a tough-fought primary in 2024?
I mean, there's so many scenarios, though. It's like that could help DeSantis or that could hurt DeSantis, just as well as if Trump endorsed him if he lost to him, right? So many things have to come into play. So do I think DeSantis could win? Yeah, I mean, he's already winning in literally every state right now, but it's so early, and you never want to be the front runner early, right? So then my advice to DeSantis would be just don't run yet. Like, wait, you got time. Wait 6 months and let this thing calm down a little bit.
Particularly if you're the governor of Florida, you don't want to be the front runner, because Jeb Bush was crushing Trump in 2016 in the polls. Yep. And then, boom, evaporated.
Yep. That's right. So we got plenty of time to figure this out. But there's no reason to be rushed into it right now. Anything else, Jerry?
There's one more by James Quindell. He asked, what should we do to get James' campaign for president going?
First of all, James Altucher, and I love James Quindell, just for the record. He's a loyal, good listener. I think both of us have been on his podcast. What do we need to do? I think you got to be, I don't know. What would your position be? Your number one position be?
My number one position would be two things. One is, I would want to basically eliminate every government department that's useless.
Okay.
Like the Department of Education. What good have they done? U.S. Education has declined versus the world every year for the past 50 years. And college, my daughter's college semester tuition this year is $61,000. Tuition plus everything else. Just for one half of a year.
And what is their endowment, right? Because they have
probably, 20 billion.
Yeah. Huh? 20 billion. Right. Exactly. Think about that.
I mean, it's insane. And then even like down to the elementary school or kindergarten level, we're just declining in all of the math scores, reading scores, everything.
You would do a Twitter style cut to the education system, an Elon Musk Twitter cut.
Not an Elon Musk style, a James style. I tweeted last September, that you need 12 people to run Twitter. And I still believe that. It's not rocket science, Twitter. It's the easiest website in the world. So you could have made, 12 people could have made that site. Well, one person made that site, Jack Dorsey. You need about a dozen people to run it. Second, and I'm not just talking about the Department of Education, like every department. The IRS, I would eliminate the IRS. We make so much money on sales. I would figure out other ways to make money with the government than, I mean, individual income taxes used to be 3% 100 years ago. And the less money in government, the more taxes you could generate from the private sector. All this government spending, including spending on the IRS, is like a waste of money. So I would focus more on sales taxes, luxury taxes, one-time, not necessarily a wealth tax, but, other types of taxes. These income taxes are crazy that you're taxed at so many levels. When I make money, first I'm taxed on income. Then when I buy something, I'm taxed on everything I buy. Then if I put money into a company to save money, I'm taxed on the dividends. Like ultimately, how many taxes are taken out of $1 of every thing you pay? You can't have a country innovate on a technical basis if all the money goes back to the government. It's impossible. We didn't start having the computer revolution until John F. Kennedy incredibly decreased taxes down from like 90%. So I'd get rid of that. And I'd also stay isolationist. I don't believe in sending 18-year-olds off to war unless you're willing to send the congressmen who vote for it to war. So I just do not believe 18-year-olds should kill themselves for things they have no understanding of. So those just very simple issues. And I would eliminate all lobbying in Congress by doing this. You can only vote for an issue if you're in your home district. So no, there should be no incentive to have to go to Washington, D.C. And then it's harder for lobbyists to lobby.
I like your platform. How are you going to raise the money, James?
I'm going to call Phil Stutz, and he's going to find me some super PACs to back me.
Yeah.
And
you'll get,
we're going to only advertise on Twitter.
Ad spend. So there you go.
No, only on Twitter. I'm not doing TV advertising because nobody watches TV anymore.
Right.
So it's only Twitter and Facebook I'm going to advertise on.
All right.
So
let's roll.
There we go. That's my campaign.
I like your platform. I think you got to condense it down and have a better answer. But those are three really good policies. I like it.
I think eliminate the IRS is probably the best one.
Yeah. Well, especially since they just hired 87,000 new agents. So I think you could win on that one.
And by the way, who's sweating in their pants because of that? That are, you know, not Jeff Bezos, but middle America.
No, they've got lawyers that can fight it. It's a small business person.
People don't understand that very wealthy people do not pay taxes because they don't make income. Jeff Bezos doesn't make a salary that's taxed, and most of his wealth he's never realized, meaning he's never sold the stocks. And you cannot, as opposed to what AOC thinks and Elizabeth Warren, you cannot tax unrealized gains because that's going to cause the stock market to basically crash every tax season.
Right.
So the stock market will never go up again.
Well, and what happens in a bad economy? What dividends are you going to have? Right. So,
yeah, zero.
Zero.
So, but all right. Well, Phil, thanks so much. And I look forward to doing this again. It was a lot of fun. And hey,
we've had a rush of three shows in the last few weeks. We're all going to take a break from this for a while. So,
but it will heat up again.
It will heat up again.
Rest assured.
I'll be back.
Thanks again, Phil.
See you guys.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.